Welcome to the Winter Palace. I'm your host, Mark Cole, editor and publisher of Odessa's Hips Magazine. Today on the show, we talk to comics creator Jeff Parker about a number of his current and past works. We start by talking about Future Quest, the DC Hanna-Barbera team-up book featuring Johnny Quest, Space Ghost, and a multitude of others. We talk about how the book came to be and his continuing collaboration with artist Doc Shaner and colorist Jordy Belair, who we also worked with on the Shazam Convergence series last year. We talk about Batman 66, its creation, getting image rights for all the actors from the television show, and which villains were the most fun to write. There's also talk of some of Jeff's past work, including Agents of Atlas, the Marvel Adventures books, including the story about how the Galactus playing baseball issue came to be, X-Men First Class, Meteor Man, and a bunch of other stuff. Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoy the show. One of the most anticipated comics of the summer was Future Quest, DC's team-up of the classic Hanna-Barbera adventure cartoons. We're happy to say that the writer of Future Quest is here to talk about that and some of his other projects. It's my old pal, Jeff Parker.
Hey.
How's it going, Jeff?
Hey, thanks for having me on.
That's cool. We are suffering through some technical glitches, so if this sounds less than optimal, I'd like to apologize to everybody, but we're finally recording, so we're going to give it a go.
Yeah.
So, how did Future Quest come about?
It was interesting. Right before I was going to Baltimore last year, I had written to Dan DiDio about something else, and he said, hey, there's something we've got we were hoping you'd do. And he's like, don't share this. And then he sends me an email with just that picture that Darwin Cook drew of all the characters together. And I was like, what? And the nice thing was Darwin was going to be at the show too. So I talked to Dan a little bit, and then I went to the show and talked to Darwin. And essentially, I think Darwin had been approached when Dan realized they could do Hanna-Barbera stuff now. And, like, they'd slapped a big catalog down in front of him and said, look at all this. And he asked Darwin about how he would go about doing a big event with a bunch of characters together. And bless Darwin, he said, I'd get Parker and Shaner to do it. So initially, then I met Darwin in person again. I mean, I'd met him before. He was working at Sony Animation when I worked there back in 99. And he was working on the Men in Black cartoon, and I was working on the Big Guy and Rusty the Boy Robot. Anyway, it was cool to see him and talk again. I always liked seeing him. But then he and I started hashing it out, and he just kind of painted out this sort of vision of stuff that could happen in the first issue. And then I went home. In fact, I didn't even make it home. I was just riding on the airplane because stuff kept coming to me. And as soon as I got back in Oregon, I sent him a big document full of how Future Quest, and it's the basic thing is all there of how Future Quest could bring all these characters together. And he was really into it. And we kicked it back and forth a little bit for the final pitch. And that's essentially how it came together. Then he had to bow out, and I thought it was at the time because he had other stuff to work on. And now, as we all know in retrospect, it was probably about the time he was finding out about his cancer diagnosis.
One of the things that I wondered about is, like you said, Hanna-Barbera is now sort of under the Time Warner umbrella, but you've done a bunch of what I would call licensed books with other people's characters, other than just sort of, you know, DC and Marvel. Did you have to go through a level of approval for stuff other than the DC office? Was there, like, somebody else you guys had to go to get stuff approved?
Yeah, but I have no idea who it was. They did send some stuff over to an HB wing or something like that, and they seemed fine with everything we were doing. So, you know, I don't recall actually any trouble through that part. It just took a while.
Without sort of spoiling anything, was there anybody that you guys wanted to use that you weren't in, that you couldn't end up using, or was everything pretty much greenlit?
It was all pretty much greenlit. The only thing we added on was Shaner wouldn't stop drawing pictures of Dino Boy. And he kept like, it's like, this is great, Doc, but we're supposed to be working on this. And they're not in the story. And he just kind of kept slipping them in until finally I asked, and then Marie Javins got permission, and and Dan said if he wants to draw dinosaurs, then if you can fit it in, do it. So, and I'm really glad because actually the Dino Boy section kind of holds a lot of it together. It makes perfect sense in the story, and it was like, and you wouldn't know that we weren't originally planning him to be in there. It was great.
And you and Doc had worked on the Shazam Convergence book,
Yeah.
and then did you guys do it? Have you guys worked anywhere else? Did you work on any of the? Did he work on any of the King stuff with you?
Yes,
I okay.
he and I did Flash Gordon.
Okay, yeah, I couldn't
Oh,
remember
you got to go back
or
and read
not.
that. That was
No, I mean I read all those. I just didn't remember
Oh, okay.
who I didn't remember who drew it.
Yeah, we did Flash Gordon, and it was funny because I had when DC had called saying they were doing Convergence, I got to listen to a list of the different characters. And I just kept rudely interrupting, going, "Captain Marvel, is Captain Marvel in there somewhere?" And finally they said, "Yeah, but he's further down the line. Listen to the whole list." And then finally they get to Captain Marvel, and I went, "I still want him." And the nice thing was, I think Marie and Brittany Holzer, the assistant editor, then kind of snuck around behind my back while we were still working on Flash Gordon and asked Evan and Jordy if they wanted to work on Shazam, because it's no big secret that Shaner loves Captain Marvel. It's like, okay, we found an artist. I'm like, oh great, I wanted to get somebody good. I didn't even know who they were going to say, and then they're like, these two people we think would work really well with you. And I was like, oh, that was sneaky. So it was great too, though, because it's always really nice when you have a whole team you've worked with and now you've all kind of gotten in sync. And then to go on to something that you're all really into, that was just a great time.
Now, that was on my list of things to ask about, but I'll just ask now.
Yeah, go
That
ahead and
was
do it now.
probably one of the better received Convergence books, I think. Has there ever been any talk of maybe doing more at some point, or is that just sort of a one-time thing?
They briefly mentioned something to us, and at that point we were starting to work on other stuff, and then Future Quest came up. But I was like, you're just gonna do the thing where he's called Shazam and blah blah blah. And it's like, I was really only in it for the original Fawcett version, which is, even this is still the kind of the 70s DC version, picking up from Fawcett. But those Fawcett books were just some of my favorite stuff, and I think it's the same thing with Doc. Now I forgot whatever the original question was now.
No, I was going to say, what might there be more at some point
I guess it's
of you guys?
possible. It's they have their kind of take, and I don't know that they want to see another alt universe sort of version of it, which is the one we kind of really like.
Right.
But maybe. Lately, he and I can't stop talking about Superman, so I have a feeling. I can't say anything because we haven't pitched anything like this, but I have a feeling the fact that we keep talking about Superman while we're doing this leans more towards we're getting in a Superman mode. But you never know.
In addition to Doc drawing this book, issue one had parts of the book drawn by Steve Rude, who people of my age and your age remember doing that Space Coast book,
Yes.
25 years ago or so. So how is it working with him? I mean, did he talk about when those guys did that book back in the 80s?
Yeah, we talked about it a little bit. He prefers to talk on the phone, so we've talked and gone over stuff. And of course, we just talk about Alex Toth and stuff we like. But yeah, and I was like the biggest Nexus fan on the East Coast, as far as I know. I was just so into that book when he was working on it.
Well, that's one. That's something that since they've been bringing out those archives that like I've gone back and read because I remember reading it, you know, as like a teenager and probably not really getting a lot of it.
Yeah.
And so I think reading it now, especially since it's sort of been, you know, remastered and whatever, like, yeah, you can see why it was. I mean, like a lot of that first stuff from that era, you know, it's like Nexus and Flag and, you know, Grimjack and Badger and all that kind of stuff that even sort of 30 years later, I think really holds up well.
Yeah, oh yeah. No, it has a very classic feel to it. And it's, you know, even for the people who like heavy serious stuff, it's got plenty of that. Nexus is straight up killing people all the time. You know, they're not playing around.
One of the books that you just finished doing is Batman 66, which I loved. That's something I think we talked about before, but now that we're on the pod, how was it working on that in the deal with getting the likenesses and who you could use and who you couldn't use and which characters you basically had to recreate? What kind of process was involved in that?
It's interesting because the whole process was happening while we did the book. Like when I first got asked to do it by Jim Chadwick, we had the basic crew likenesses. We had Batman and Robin, but we didn't have Alfred, and we didn't have Gordon and O'Hara, and then we had the main villains. We had Julie Newmar, Catwoman, Cesar Romero, Burgess Meredith, and Frank Gorshin. And then they were reaching out trying to secure the thing with the estates of the other actors, which they couldn't necessarily do in all the cases. In some cases, like they're, you know, they probably couldn't track down heirs, and weren't sure what to do in some situations. It was always a really tricky, whoever in the producer's end untangled all that. They had to do a lot of footwork because it was all divvied up between several studios. And that's why, like, when Mike Allred tried to do the Adam West Batman doing the Batusi on his solo issue years ago, he couldn't do it because they actually didn't have the rights to that version of Batman. It was owned by Fox Greenwood and all that kinds of things, which is really interesting. I don't know why everybody put it out like DC hates this version of Batman. It's like, DC just doesn't have any rights to it because of the way the TV worked. So anyway, they started getting that untangled. And as I understand it, the book in some way helped kind of build the case for doing it. So like they obviously the end goal was always to get those DVD collections out there, but the book kind of helped serve the purpose with that too, which was nice. One of my favorite things was you know, they didn't really know who Jonathan Case was originally. And I was like, I think Jonathan ought to draw one of these stories. And, you know, and they said, well, maybe if he could send some stuff over. And, you know, whenever they invite an artist, even half-heartedly, to do something, that's when you've got to just blow them away with whatever you send over. And he immediately did a Julie Newmar Catwoman and a few other pieces. And it was no time before they were going, well, Jonathan's the lead artist, and then we're gonna, you know, it's like they completely did a 180. It became all about Case. And it's cool, you know, he's worked on Future Quest a little bit in the last issue too. And one of my favorite things was Julie Newmar sent him an email. Like, I don't know how she got his email. Maybe she just called and they called the comics offices and then gave it to her because who's gonna turn her down? And she sent over a bunch of pictures of herself that she liked. And I was like, I love that she's still that vain, that she's like picking out her favorite pics and sending them on. Well, make sure that artist knows these, you know?
Do you have a favorite arc or a favorite villain that you got to write? Like maybe like somebody you loved as a kid, and you're like, I can't believe I finally get to put Louis the Lilac or the Bookworm or King Tut into a comic book.
Well, yeah, all those. And, oh, that made me remember. I was going to finish answering your question. we still never got all the, as we went on with the series, we started getting rights to different characters. You know, like they'd say Bookworm, now you can make him look like Roddy McDowell, you know, or something like that. And at first, you can probably tell by looking through that we didn't have the rights to Alan Napier. So Alfred is always in shadow, or he doesn't look the same, or he looks sort of like normal comics Alfred. And then suddenly he looks just like Alfred from the show, and that's when the rights kicked in. The ones we never got, though, we got some other random rights, like Batgirl we were waiting on, and got Batgirl's rights, like right as Colleen Coover had turned in the first Batgirl story. And then she was like, I don't want it to look like I don't know how to draw Von Craig. So she just went back and redid several panels so that it would look like her. And I just like, I love that. She just couldn't stand, much like Julie Newmar, couldn't stand people thinking in a different way. We never got the rights to Gordon and O'Hara. That was the thing. It's always like, so Chief O'Hara is just all over the place with looks. He's just always a, you know, kind of bulbous Irishman. And Gordon always looks sort of like Neil Hamilton and sort of like the Gordon you know from the comics. He usually has glasses on. So that was part of the whole rights likeness thing. I can't say that. As to characters that I was really looking forward to, I was super excited to get to do King Tut. I really enjoyed doing those stories. Scott Kowalczyk especially just like went all out on his. You could tell he was just delighted to work on it, and just kept putting in his own little shout outs and sound effects. Let's see, who else did I like to do? Obviously I wanted to do Frank Gorshin. That's why I started with him. I felt like he was the first one on the TV show, so he should be the first one in the comic. Because he really set the tone. He said, it's weird. Frank Gorshin, as a personality, set the tone for not only the Riddler, but the Joker, really.
Now, I don't know the answer to this, but did you guys do any Riddler stories where you used the John Astin Riddler, or did you always use the Frank Gorshin Riddler?
We going back to Kowalczyk, we did sneak in the John Astin Riddler in the beginning of our Bane story. So for a second, he's got a costume on, and it makes it, they would, because they didn't have the rights to John Astin, but we kind of found a little loophole there where we could just for a second show him looking like John Astin. And I never wanted to do the John Astin one. I loved him as Gomez, but I never liked him as the Riddler. And then Kowalczyk sent over this piece where he had done him as Astin, and I was like, God, I actually like this. And like, he actually convinced me on it. So yeah, for a couple of panels, you see him that way, and then he pulls off a rubber mask and he's Frank Gorshin again. So it ended up being a pretty good in joke, at least.
That's cool. And I mean, for me, it's like getting to see Egghead. I think you guys used him a couple of different times.
Oh yeah.
That was very cool.
Egghead's great. Well, Vincent Price has never phoned anything in his life. Everything he ever did. He always found a hook, and he always made it really enjoyable. And just as much with Egghead, you know, my often collaborator Sandy Gerrell did that first Egghead story. Then Brent Schoonover did one. It was really, really fun to do Egghead because, one, you have to think, oh man, am I going to run out of egg words? But you don't, because there's so many EX words that you can turn into egg. Everything's excruciating and that and this.
And he was also in the Batman Man from U.N.C.L.E. book that ended not that long ago. I assume that was also really cool, doing that.
That was interesting. When they asked me to do it, I was like, wait, you just announced the Avengers one, and I didn't know about this. And that's when I realized that they had planned to do all these 60s crossovers. You know, I was like, all right. And I was sitting down, just kind of really, I was at that point, I knew it was going to be David Hahn as the artist. And I was just trying to figure out who would be fun to see David draw. And David then with Carl Kiesel, you know, who's just a powerhouse in any part of the assembly line he feels like getting in on, he's good at. He's a good writer. He's a good inker. He's a good artist. I don't know if he colors though, but that whole series was pretty rewarding. It was a little tricky to pull off because I had to get the tone I felt just right. Because I went back and watched some of the very early Men from U.N.C.L.E.s, Man from U.N.C.L.E.s, and which sounds like I'm saying the plural wrong. And then I was like, oh yeah, I hadn't seen these in a long time. They were serious at the beginning. You know, it wasn't actually chasing after the Batman kind of feel.
Yeah, some of the black and white era ones are.
It's really good.
Yeah.
And then I know I felt like everybody's probably expecting that what we're going to do is mash up Batman with later Man from U.N.C.L.E., but I was so into the first ones, I was like, no, let's actually make Batman a little more serious this time and make him fit into the Man from U.N.C.L.E. early seasons. And I feel like it worked pretty well. We went a little broader towards the end. We started getting into the big James Bond stuff, but at first we were keeping it kind of pared down and a little more street level, and I liked the feel of it.
And you're not writing the Avengers one that's currently ongoing, but are there going to be any more, do you know?
Yeah.
Or is this it?
There's one they're going to announce in San Diego, and I will only tease it by saying it's the one everybody's been waiting for.
Which is funny, because when they announced the Avengers one, we started coming, like, some friends and I were speculating, like, what other 60s thing would work. And I presume this isn't what you're talking about, because I think it's possibly too obscure for most American audiences, but...
Danger Diabolic?
No, it's Batman...
That's the one I was trying to get them to do. I was like, can we do Danger Diabolic? And they're like, no. And it's like, I think you can get the rights really cheap. It would be super cool, because yeah. I was completely at the start of the series saying that to every artist. Like, I want it to look like Mario Bava. Mario Bava's Danger Diabolic. Because I feel like that just nailed that whole look. But
yeah,
anyway, what's yours? Let me hear.
My idea was Batman and Deadman teaming with Randall and Hopkirk deceased. Because if you don't know that show, it's like a pair of private eyes, and in the pilot one of them gets killed, but he comes back as a ghost.
Right.
And his partner is the only guy that can see him. And so you get a lot of that sort of 60s where, you know, the ghost opens and, you know, one, he can, you know, he knows everything that's going on because he can just pop everywhere. And you get the thing where he opens the doors and he blows out stuff and all that kind of stuff. So it's sort of like Deadman. You know, it's like only one person can see him.
Jesus, Mark. Like, way to pick something that there was one season of and nobody knows about.
Well,
it's hard enough
again,
with, we were lucky Man from U.N.C.L.E. got a movie. you might as well team him up with Topper if you're going to do that. But even though I am, like, the world's biggest Deadman fan, and I love the idea of Deadman getting in there, and I wish I'd gotten him in the series somewhere. It's like, did you ever watch the Brave and the Bold cartoon? Oh, I love when Deadman turned up on there.
Yeah, I went back. I watched a bunch of those when I interviewed DeMatteis on the podcast, because he had written a bunch of Brave and the Bold, and he wrote a bunch of the Justice League cartoons. And, yeah, there were some that I apparently, like, had missed seeing. And, you know, I think that cartoon is, in its way, just as good as, like, you know, the Bruce and Paul stuff.
Oh, yeah. No,
it's just, I
kind of prefer it. Like, and I love that they got the Gentleman Ghost on there. Oh.
Yeah, I used to be a huge Gentleman Ghost, Mark, from, I think probably from, you know, when he was in the Super Friends.
Yeah.
Way back when. But I think that's such a great design, too.
Yeah, he's just this top hat and a floating monocle.
But the I love the Batman 66 book, so I'm glad there's going to be at least one more before they're done.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, you know, it's the 50th anniversary, so there's no way they're not going to do more. But I do think this next miniseries we're about to announce is going to be the biggest.
That's
what
cool
a Donald
for
Trump thing for me to say. It's going to be so good. It's going to be the best.
In San Diego, yeah, so that'd only be a couple weeks if you say they're going to announce it at San Diego.
Yeah.
One of the things that I thought we could talk about, since we talked about this when Paul and Colleen were on the show a little while ago, and that's, and I know this is something you like talking about, and that's sort of the whole all ages concept, because you and Paul and Fred did like such great work on those Marvel adventure books, which I always, you know, I think sometimes those books, and sort of when DC did the same thing with the Batman and Superman ones, that since you get to write sort of such archetypal versions of the characters and you're not bogged down with continuity, that I think sometimes those books can be better than sort of the mainline books because you're not hampered by everything.
Oh yeah. You don't have to, God, I don't have to email everybody in the company asking what's going on and what tone I have to keep with, which Avenger or something. You just get to do exactly what you think the core of the character is, and it's just a good time. It's like, the continuity thing really just wears you down.
And I guess I was trying to find some of my issues. The only one that I think probably the one everybody quotes is the baseball issue.
Oh, really?
I mean, I was trying to think of which plots I remembered just by sort of looking at the covers.
You know how that came about?
Please do tell.
I was at the time, I didn't even know what the next four issues were going to be, and the editor said, "Hey, we've got to keep Leonard Kirk busy. Can we get Leonard to do some covers? What are they going to be?" And just being wising off or whatever, I went, "Tell Leonard to come up with some covers, and I'll just base stories on them." We were literally doing a very old-fashioned take on the whole thing.
I was gonna say
And
that's very sort of Julie Schwartzy,
it
where
really was. And then Leonard went for it. As soon as you see like Galactus and the Silver Surfer playing baseball, I'm like, "Oh man, I've really got to figure something out now." I thought, well, no, like I think the first one I did figure out. Like I knew they had said, "Why don't you do an Agents of Atlas story?" And I was like, "Okay, maybe there's a way to do the Agents of Atlas in that." And then it ended up being one of my favorite agent stories that I ever did. Where because you have a strong hook where the Agents of Atlas find Captain America before the Avengers do, and have this whole timeline. You get to have Kang in there. I was so happy with that. I felt like that was one of the strongest ones. And then Leonard just ran with it on the rest of them. One of them was the one with Giant Girl and everybody stomping on successively smaller characters. And then there was the Galactus baseball story, which I was super happy about. Once I cracked it and figured out that it was going to be about the Ultimate Nullifier and Spider-Man and Ant-Man just set it off. I was like, man, I was starting to feel indestructible at that point. And now I'm trying to remember what the other one was that he came up with. He did another cover, and then I based something on that. Yeah, I don't have all the stuff in front of me, so.
Well, since you brought up Atlas, which is a book that I loved, and I remember, I think at one point we were going to do some sort of interview about that, and then it never came off. But is that the thing that people still bring up? Is there something else that, like, if you're doing shows, do people just mainly talk about whatever you're doing currently, or is there stuff that, even though it's been 10 or 15 years, that they'll bring up?
That's the one besides whatever current is current that people bring up. And it seems to be a lot of people who are starting to like get more solid as creators in the industry. Like I'm starting to find out, oh, this actually turned out to be a kind of influential book. Like I didn't think anybody was really that many people were reading it, but it's one of those kind of Velvet Underground things where all the people who read it apparently were planning on working in comics. So I really enjoy that, and people will come up to me and then I realize within talking a couple of minutes, like, oh, they really know their stuff. They read all of it. And that makes it super rewarding because you just worry, it's like, am I just doing this just to please myself? Did anybody actually read this? So it does feel great to know you connected with people and that they really got something out of it.
Well, I think the great thing about that book, and we were sort of talking about sort of the downside of continuity a couple minutes ago, but I think when you take something like that is so steeped, you know, in old characters and whatever, and you can sort of put a new spin on them and make them work in a different way without necessarily trotting on what made them interesting in the first place. I think, you know, those kind of books don't happen every so often, and I think when they do and they do it right, I think it certainly hits a nerve with a certain part of the readership. I mean, I think in a way, it's sort of like Starman, you know, where you took all of these old things and you smushed them together and you made something new that was progressive, but without sort of damaging what came before.
Uh-huh. Well, the important thing to remember is I did actually change a lot of the stuff that was originally there. It's just no one could check me on it because it was all stuff that wasn't in print.
Right.
So when you go back, a lot of people have a very specific take on what Ken Hale is as Gorilla Man. But if you read his original story, that it's not the case at all. I just straight up changed his background and kept certain things about it, and everybody just repeats it as if, well, that's, you know, that's scripture. And it's like, that's fine, because I wanted it to keep, you know, I did keep Marvel Boy pretty much. Everything I did with Marvel Boy lines up with what they originally did with him. And Namora, I went back and I read all Bill Everett stuff. You know, I made sure that I'm not actually, there's revelations, but there's nothing that says any of that is wrong. You know, and it was nice because there wasn't too much continuity. It wasn't like the trouble I had with X-Men First Class, where I was always having to check to see if the X-Men had ever involved themselves with these other characters and what had been said or anything. That was the real dancing through the raindrops sort of thing that actually was a lot of work. Atlas, everybody, it was pretty easy to read all their stories and put it all together from there. And I left, and you know, we kind of based it off that What If issue, and I left out 3D Man because I didn't like 3D Man. And I felt like, oh, he's a retcon character. He wasn't actually around, so I'm not going to put him in. And then they suggested it on the last series, like, what if you finally brought in 3D Man? And I was like, ugh. And then I went back and I looked at the story that Christos Gage and Dan Slott had done where they made Triathlon 3D Man. And I was like, oh, he's way more interesting now. Before, he was just, I don't know, he could do three of this, three of that. There was nothing particularly interesting about him, but Triathlon was more interesting to me. And I felt like I had a hook with him. He was a forgotten hero like the rest of the Agents of Atlas, and then he made sense in my mind to bring him in with the rest of the team.
The last thing I wanted to talk about was some of your creator-owned stuff. Is Meteor Man the most recent thing that you sort of have done independently?
Yes. Everything else is just still in formative stages, but yeah, Meteor Man with Sandy Jarrell is my most recent creator-owned property.
And I think I told you this a couple weeks ago. I was very excited to actually see our library actually had it in stock. I was
nice.
For being sort of, you know, rural bumpkin-y, you know, mid-Atlantic, that, you know, I've been very impressed at like how our graphic novel section is actually growing, and it doesn't just include, you know, 10 Batman books and 10 Spider-Man books. Because they had Meteor Man, and they also have both volumes of Bandette. I was like,
oh, good, that's a good
this
library.
This is great. I was exceptionally pleased, and Meteor Man won a bunch of awards, if I remember right. Wasn't it like Library Association Awards? Was it something like that?
Yeah, it did end up on the YALSA list, the Young Adult Library Award.
Cool. And, so that's still available. And I know some of your other older stuff is still out there, and some of it's also on Comixology, because I think Underground's on Comixology, if I remember right, and some of the others.
Yeah, I think so.
But yeah, so I would, and that you did with Steve Lieber, who people probably don't know, actually did the cover for the first issue of our magazine way back many years ago, and I'm hoping to try and get him on the pod at some point so we can talk about the fix, because I know lots of people who just love that book, and
Oh, yeah.
it seems like those guys are probably having as much fun writing it and drawing it as people are reading it.
Yeah, Steve is always happy to show what he's working on at any time with that book, because he's always just coming up with hilarious stuff. Yeah, and it is. That book's really good. I like it.
I was saying, yeah, and I seem to be, and the pod is also like collecting people who are part of your studio, because, like I said, Paul and Colleen have been on, and I think it's probably just sort of the whole Portland comics mafia. I think you're like the sixth or seventh person that's been on the pod so far that lives in Portland. So it's like it's like the new Pokemon game. It's like, collect your Portland comic book art. I know I joked
Tom
with.
Fowler always makes the joke that American cartoonists, for everybody working in the comics industry, you have to live in Portland for at least 2 years or serve an equal amount of time in jail. And it's like, yeah, it does seem kind of right as more people keep moving.
I remember I was talking, I think I was talking when I was talking to Paul and Colleen, and we were talking about the soccer team, and like initially when they were selling season tickets or whatever, and I think maybe like they were doing well, but like they hadn't sold out the stadium yet, and I was like, well, if you just sold like a season ticket to every other comics professional that lives in Portland, you would sell out the stadium.
And it's nice that we finally have the Rose City Con, which is a pretty good sized con here now. We always thought it was kind of strange. It's like, shouldn't we have a good convention? We all live here. And now we do. So that's been really enjoyable.
Cool. Jeff, I want to thank you very much for your time tonight.
Thanks.
Like we said, Future Quest 2 came out this week with a cliffhanger of the character I was wondering when they would show up, and I was happy to see they finally showed up
Oh,
in
good.
issue 2, to stir the pot, as it were. Oh, I completely forgot. I wanted to talk about how it is writing Johnny Quest. We talked about sort of the characters, but like, how is it writing Johnny Quest?
It's so surprisingly easy because, I just loved the cartoon so much as a kid that I have a pretty strong little backstory in my head of everything. And now I get to kind of allude to it, and I get to little tweak a few things. Like one of the things I wanted to do, you'll see coming up, is that I didn't want Dr. Zen to be. He's one of those that originally was still kind of, and oddly, this kind of connects to Agents of Atlas. He's still sort of presented even then as a yellow peril sort. And I was like, all right, we need to drop that. But I still want to have him in there because he was a cool villain, and now you're going to find out there's actually more of a history with him, kind of as a mentor to Dr. Benton Quest, and it's not a very just simple evil villain thing anymore. Kind of like the way we get to go into the backstory of Space Ghost and the Space Force that he was a part of. We get to kind of tease a lot of interesting stuff that. Since the cartoons sort of left it open, we get to develop it a little bit. And I want to just try to kind of keep that mythic status with everything. I don't want it to get mired in its own continuity, but I do want it to kind of play up the fact that it feels like legends, and I feel that's a strength of all of that material that we can work with.
And I'm sure the temptation with Johnny Quest is to limit how many sort of villains or references you can make without sort of overburdening this. Like, it was great that, you know, in the first issue you get the spider right away.
Oh yeah,
because I'm sure that's like maybe sort of the iconic bad guy monster, if you will.
It's just something about it. It's such a simple design, but just that single red eye moving around. I just know from years of talking to people how much it creeped everybody out. It's like, well, we can't leave that out. That's got to be a major thing right away. And we built that into the premise pretty quickly.
Yeah, I think the thing that creeped me out the most as a kid watching Johnny, which bad guy, was the invisible monster, which
had
that, like, that really creepy shriek thing when it yelled or whatever. And then, you know, eventually at the end, when you see it at the end when they drop all the paint bombs on it, and you're like, man, that's...
That was just good sci-fi is what that was. It feels kind of like some Quatermass sort of type thing. I just love that.
Yeah. Have you ever seen that Johnny Quest documentary that's on YouTube?
Yeah, I did watch it.
That is like, I mean, for being something fan made, it's like one of the best things I think like I've ever seen sort of devoted to like the history of a pop culture thing, like a TV show or something.
I feel like he did a lot of good work on it. From everything I knew from talking to Doug Wilde, it was pretty accurate. So, yeah, and I was expecting, it's like, well, there's going to be some wrong bits in there, but I was like, no, this all seems pretty on the nose.
Yeah, I will. I know I've posted it before in an article that I wrote, but I will throw a link to that in the show notes because it is a very, very comprehensive look at the show, and if you're reading this comic, that's certainly something I would definitely encourage people to look at. So issue 2 just came out this week. You said you've got some other stuff in the pipeline. Is there anything coming soon that'll be announced, like at San Diego or something?
No, nothing that soon. Not with my glacial pace, no.
Cool. Thanks again, Jeff, and thanks for suffering through our technical issues while we were getting started. So thanks again, and we'll talk to everybody next time.